Welcome to the Gear Garage Live Show. This weekly YouTube show covers whitewater rafting, river safety,
oh God, I lost my paddle,
gear, and anything else Zach feels like rambling on about.
Welcome to the show at our normal time, Tuesday at 2 p.m. And this is where I answer questions I get through the week. Some people email me, fax me, text me, Instagram message me. That's the slowest way to get me to answer a question. I don't check those things very often. The best way is to go to whitewaterguidebook.com. It's the website that we run. There's probably a link in somewhere in the down below, hopefully. And there's a tab that says ask a question. If you ask a question there, it gets cataloged and sent to me quickly. So that's the quickest way to get me to answer a question is through that. But as we find questions and emails and texts and all those things, I do try to get them added. Sometimes, honestly, if you try Instagram messaging me, it could be months. I don't live in Instagram Messenger. So let's get on with today's show. Enough of me talking about the logistics of the show. And we're talking about Collectfest and answer questions. Super straightforward a day. And the Collectfest is my personal favorite event of the year. I just think it's a lot of fun. It's, you know, some events are like just parties. There's a reason to go boating and party. It's about drinking. Some events are just about the race mainly. Some events are about, I don't know, other things. This is really like a little bit of everything, but not too much of one. So there's a bunch of races, but they're short races. And they're races for everyone. They're races for rafts and kayaks and duckies. Inflatable kayaks. Subs, pack rafts. There's races for everybody. You don't have to do them. You can watch races. And it's really fun to watch the race. And it's really convenient to sit there and just watch people do the races. There's tons of vendors. Like for the West Coast, probably more vendors than any other event. All the major raft manufacturers there, all the good gear companies are there. You can demo gear. So if you want to go boating, it's really convenient to put in and take out right by the event site. Like if you haven't been to the Clackamas, it's hard to understand. But the road just goes right by the river, and the road's shorter than the river. The river kind of winds around where the road is. And so you can try different brands of boats out. Maybe if there's like an oar you want to try out, Sawyer might let you take it. I don't know if they will or not. Or it's just a chance to try things, see like the local homegrown companies. This is less about the big corporate gear companies and more like local, small grassroots gear companies there at the event. And there's camping right there. And so in the evening, there's a band and there's a chance to go talk to all your friends, fellow buds. You can meet people or see old friends. And it goes from Friday through Sunday morning. And so you can come show for all of it or part of it. It's just easy, fun. And it's not like Golly Fest where people are just getting drunk and, you know, jumping on top of what are those things? Creature crafts. And it's not about the partying. It's more about just a really good time with the community and safety and just boating. So if you're around, I know it's a busy spring weekend. Maybe that weekend, there's lots of stuff going on, but it's just a cool event. I'd highly recommend going if you live in the area or even out of the area. It's worth driving from like Montana for. It's that great of a time. Okay. And the long-term forecast right now shows we'll have low flow guaranteed. It's going to be low. But we should have great weather according to the long-term forecast. All right, first question. This one's a doozy. Okay, as I mentioned, my wonderful and talented son pulled a Metal Fork Salmon permit with a launch date of June 27th. Awesome. I think you said you're printing a couple days before. Yeah, I launched June 25th on a trip. I know you're pretty guarded in your favorite campsite in the Middle Fork, but we're thinking of trying to go for the below. If you have any input, I would appreciate your honest thoughts. Also open to other camp suggestions. Thanks. I'm not really guarded about my favorite camps, but I have to be careful because I have people listen to the show more than other shows. So if I tell you my favorite camp, people will start wanting to camp there just because I said that. And just because it's my favorite camp doesn't mean it's your favorite camp. What makes a camp great is its location on the river, scenery, fishing, proximity to hiking, proximity to hot springs, the size of it. Some people like big, large camps. Some people like small, intimate camps. Sand, no sand. Like, there's not one camp for everybody. Camps that are my favorite personally have hikes, potentially swimming, and they're camps I've had fun at before. And usually for me to have fun, it's like a tight, there's lots of trees and it forces everybody together in like a really comfortable way. That's what I like, but I don't fish. So like fishing isn't a priority for me. So if you fish, you might like a camp for a different reason. You might like big open spaces, which is not my thing. So for me to tell my favorite camps, it drives people to those camps and then those camps get overused. An example is the Rogue. If you ask people, what are the best camps in the Rogue? Almost everybody's going to say Rogue River Ranch in the mouth of Mule Creek. That is not the best camp on the river. It's definitely a nice camp, but it is not the best camp on the river. But everybody thinks that because it's where it just gets passed down from person to person to person. Same thing, like people love Horseshoe Bend on the Rogue. It's okay. Like it's a good camp, but I never camp at either of those places because I know everybody's going there. Like those are like actually camps I avoid because they're crowded and they're smaller, cooler camps that are not, they're still big because when I'm on the Rogue, I usually have a big group that are lesser known that I like way more. Again, because of proximity to the trail, because of more privacy, right? Rogue River Ranch, there's tons of other groups. Like I don't like that. There's less privacy. There's just camps. I'm not going to share what those are because then everybody's going to want to camp there. And really like exploring new camps every trip you do is part of the joy of boating. And so I'd highly encourage everybody to disperse more and try things out instead of always trying to get the best camps, because the best camps does not mean the same for everybody. That's my long-winded answer to I'm guarded on hearing. I'm not guarded, but I'm afraid to tell people what my personal favorite camps are because they'll choose to camp there when it's not the best camp for them and their needs. In terms of the Middle Fork, first of all, June 27th is a sweet date. It's going to be sweet, great flows, probably some of the best flows of the year. My guess is like 2.5 feet, 3 feet maybe, just solid, like great time, right? Like you should be solid. It's a great time to be on the Middle Fork. Pretty much in the Middle Fork, all the camps are great. They all have their pluses and minuses, right? Like some camps are like more scenic, but also like, there happen to be a lot of bees there in the fall, or like some camps, there's one camp that has amazing pictographs, but the walk up the rocks to camp is really tricky. My favorite Groover spot is at a different camp, but also it's a tricky walk up to camp. And so you're trading off. It's always a trade off. So like I've said earlier, okay, so let me go through these input. Night one with low water expected. Well, first of all, it's June 27th. I'm not expecting low water. If you went in August, we could talk about low water. Like I'm going to run a trip on the Middle Fork August 28th. I expect low water August 28th. I do not expect low water June 27th. June 27th, first of all, and the Middle Fork isn't even that bad of a snowpack. People are freaking out about the West for good reason. If you're in Colorado, here in Oregon, except for the Rogue, because again, the Rogue is dam controlled. So there's plenty of, and the reservoir is full. So the Rogue is fine, but non-dam controlled rivers, the Middle Fork snowpack is probably 60-70% right now, which is not great, but it's better than Oregon, which is a lot of places 10. And there's plenty of water, especially June 27th, right? June 27th is a great date. I will not call June 27th low water, right? I'm not going to accept that. So don't want to go far the first 2 days. Yeah, do what you want. It's up to you. Again, it's not low water, so I'm not going to stress out about that, about not going far the first days. Trail flat, hot springs, but camp up on a bench. Yeah, I mean, awesome hot spring, but it's a bit of a carry to the camp. Is it an issue? It's an issue if you don't like carrying stuff uphill. Big Bend is a sweet camp. Sandy Pullen. Yeah, I think I would honestly rather camp at Big Bend, even though trail flat has the hot springs. I find when I camp at a hot spring, I don't take advantage of it. Like I go there for half an hour, come back, done. I could have done that even if I didn't camp there. We could have pulled over and done that. So like I'm not personally fanatical about hot spring camps, and Big Bend is a better camp. And Elkhorn's sweet too. Yeah, those are all short mileage days. First, you could put on at noon and you'd get there no problem at all. Here, Brendan has a comment about Middle Fork snowpack. Been watching the Middle Fork snowtail sites. They seem to be plenty of water July 21st. Yeah, I mean, July 21st, yeah, you're going to be pushing 2 feet. But yeah, I mean, can I open up a web page here? Let me see if I can go to where I look at my page for flows. One second. it really, like, there's times when it seemed bad, but let me see if they'll allow me to share this page. Let's see. Share. Sorry, everybody. I know this is not riveting when I do this. So this is the page on Whitewater Guidebook I have for the Middle Fork Salmon Flow. And some of the graphs, like these ones, don't exist anymore, so I need to fix that. But the snowwater equivalent graph is here. When it was right here and going down, yeah, that was scary, because this line right here is the lowest ever and down like that. And that's pretty bad. And so when it was doing this, it was looking terrifying. But then we get some snow and it melted and some snow and it melted and it pushed it all over. And so right now it's actually melting pretty fast. Like the slope of that curve is definitely steeper than that slope. So it's melting fast, but it's going to end up in between the lowest ever and average, which is going to be a low water year, but not terrible. And yeah, I mean, it's going to be low, but like I've done seasons out there where it's much worse. So this is not great, but it's also not like apocalyptic or horrible. It's, and especially end of June is fine. Anyway, I've talked about that too much already. Let's go back to the question. Okay. So yeah, those are short days. And honestly, like at the flow you're going to have, you might want to put it at noon, let everybody go downstream. Everybody go to do all their things and then have a sleep in that morning, go for a hike, put on at noon, and you'll be at any of those camps, you know, unless you have a problem at Velvet, which you could, I guess. I would worry more about the new rapids at Hell's Half Mile and Velvet than I would about low water. The new rapids might cause problems. Night 2, Dolly Lake or Pistol. Yeah, those are cool camps. Across Dolly's confusing. Let's see. One of them is called Dolly and one of them is called Big Snag. And they're across the river from each other. And the Forest Service labeled them wrong on a map one year. So both Dolly, the camp at Dolly Lake, which used to be called Big Snag, but you might be calling Dolly Lake, and the camp across from it, Big Snag, or what used to be called Dolly Lake. Sorry, this is confusing. Great camps. Pistol, great camp. Yep, you're cool camp. By the way, this all depends on group size. I don't know. I'm guessing you're like 12-ish people, 10-ish people. So like, all of those first night camps are great for that size. Dolly is a huge camp. So, you know, maybe wouldn't take a huge camp if you're 12 people, just to be respectful for other groups. But Pistol Creek's a smaller site. All right. Night 3, Jackass Upper, Jackass Lower, Stateland Left. Yeah. I mean, that those are cool camps. Those are all great camps. I like Upper more. I mean, what says decent camp with many sites and trees? I think it's Upper. I always get Upper and Lower confused. I think it's Upper. Yeah, Upper is what I'm thinking of. Upper, I would not call decent. I would call Upper an awesome camp. But that's where I differ with most people. I love Upper Jackass because I love the way the sun sets there. And there is a really cool hike I love doing there. And the camp is the camp. It's a great camp. It's nothing bad about it, you know. So, like, I think it's an amazing camp because it has great hiking and because I know the sunsets are amazing. Jackass felt lower. I haven't camped there forever. I would not call that one of my favorite camps. State Left is a massive camp, but you're close to the airport, so you can have air traffic potentially. So, again, it's State Left, awesome, huge camp. Probably too large for if you're 10 or 12 people, it's a little disrespectful to take a camp as large as State Left, I think. So, I probably wouldn't go to State Left. Even Jackass Upper is probably too big for a medium, small size group, but I find something smaller just to be respectful. Night 4, Hospital Bar. Yeah, cool camp. Hospital Bar is one of the best camps on the river, except it can get windy. And so you're playing roulette with wind. You know, if there's no wind, awesome. You know, you camp right by this like Kulo Hot Spring, you know, big, cool area, beautiful. But if it's windy, it's like being on the moon. I don't know what being on the moon is like, but what I imagine being on the moon is like. And you know, and at this point, like once you got to here, you're now just on a normal 6-day schedule. Let's say you're doing a 7-day trip. You're now just on a 6-day schedule. You spent the first, you know, 2 nights up high and now you're just doing normal mileage. And all those camps night 3 are awesome. If I had a group of 10, I'd go Tappan Island because you can camp on an island in the river. And that's kind of unique with a small group, something you can do. And you're not taking a camp that, like, again, 25 people might want. You're not crowding camps. Night four hospital ball. Run night four. Sorry. Oh, so that's run night four hospital. But yeah, that, like I said, that one's sweet. Can get windy. It says that there. Little grouse is stunning. It is amazing camp. Yeah, beautiful shade. I guess there's shade. There's some shade. There's shade everywhere. Night five Wilson. Yeah, Wilson's a good camp. I mean, all those night four camps are awesome. Yeah, all those night four. I mean, even the ones that people don't like upper and lower, or the grassy one, grassy two, are still great camps. So you really honestly can't go wrong night four. Yeah, here Courtney's saying, oh, it's 16 people. Yeah, that's like a medium group. I guess you can take larger sites and not feel bad about it. Yeah, Little Grouse is epic. It's not my favorite camp, but yeah, God, it's pretty awesome. I could make the case for being my favorite camp. It's a tough pull in though. Like if you don't make the eddy, like it's a small eddy. So if your boater, if you don't know where the camp is or you didn't catch the eddy, somebody can miss the eddy and be gone. And so you're gambling a little bit. You have to be very confident in catching the eddy. Night five is Wilson. Yeah, Wilson's great. All of night five camps are right. I call these night four camps. And their last night, Otter Bar. Yeah, everybody wants Otter Bar. Sandy Beach. It's like mile 90. It's close to takeout. Great swimming. Yeah, Paraplacer. Yeah, also awesome. Otter has the big beach. Paraplacer has a small beach. Paraplacer, it's intimate. Like, it's fun. Like, it gets everybody together. And Elk Bar is amazing. It's just a long last day for most people, so they don't take it. Like, we got last pick for camps once for the last night when everything was just taken because, like, groups of five were taking large sites ahead of us, which I don't think it should be allowed, but the Forest Service allowed at that time. I think there was even, like, a Forest Service group taking camps. And so the only camp left for us on the last night was Otter Bar, and I think it was low water. And so, you know, we had to go like whatever it is, 20-ish miles the last day. And we had people that had flights that night. And so we got up super early, and you can push out from Elk Bar if you need to. It makes for a big last day. And the problem with Elk Bar is if you want to stop at places like Vail Falls or Paris Grotto, some of the like better known places, I'm pretty sure Elk Bar is upstream of all that, right? Yeah, it's upstream. So you have to do that your last day or skip it, right? People want to can't pass there. So at the end of their fifth day, they can make those like iconic stops and their last day get out. My recommendation though, for any of this, is make your last day a long day. All the outfitted groups were on kind of a schedule because we, you know, have to get people to town by a certain time. Some people have flights they have to make. So we all get there to take out around, you know, 11 o'clock noonish. And so you can almost be guaranteed there's three commercial groups at takeout at 11 o'clock or noon. So as a private group, if you choose to get there 11 o'clock or noon, you're just becoming part of the disaster. I'm not saying don't get there 11 o'clock. If you need to get there 11 o'clock or noon, do it. But you could choose to show up at 2 o'clock and the ramp will be empty. You can make that conscious choice to be like, hey, you know what? We're not going to rush off the river as fast as we can. If I, as a commercial guide, could take out a two, I would. We just have we have obligations. Our guests have to sometimes get places. So we set our takeout time. And I feel like on all the rivers we work, whatever time the commercial guides take out, the privates choose that exact same time. I'm not sure if that's just their favorite time to take out, or they're in a hurry to get done and they just want to, you know, push down a takeout, or if they like a crowded take. I have no idea why that's the case, right? But if you camped at Elk Bar, you know, launched, went down on your last day, went to Vail Falls, there would be nobody there. You'd own Vail Falls. You can make all the stops you wanted. You could take out naturally around 2, 2:30. There'd be nobody to take out. You'd quickly load up and you'd be on your way, right? I would do that if I was a private boater, personally, because again, I don't want to get there when all the commercial companies are there. But if you want to get there when all the commercial companies are there, then choose Otter, because you're 10 miles from takeout. No matter how long you sleep in, you're still going to launch and be at takeout around 11:30. Like, you just can't help yourself. So Otter basically forces you to be there when all the commercial companies are there. Elk Bar makes you hold back a little bit, and or like, on your last day, enjoy the river a little bit more, go for a hike. I would really encourage any private boaters to not choose the exact same time commercial companies get out. Now, you can, but it just creates a disaster for everybody. Okay, so hopefully that answers the questions. I want to say you're probably not going to get these camps because the way that the camp pick system works, don't get too attached to a camp. Like, I know it's for a lot of you, your Middle Fork trip is a trip of a lifetime and you want the best camps possible. They're all good camps. You're still going to have a great time. The way you're going to submit camps, you're going to submit your choices. Just submit some choices. Be like, cool, I'm on the Middle Fork. All the camps are good. There's no camp I can think of. Well, there's one I can think of that's horrible, but nobody ever camps there anymore. It's overgrown with weeds. And I haven't camped. I've only camped there once ever. And so, like, I don't think even they assign that camp anymore. And, don't camp at, like, Fire Island, because I don't know if they assign that one anymore either, because, like, there's logs in the way of where you would stop. But there's so many more great camps than you listed. So just be happy. Like, submit some camps. Be like, cool, I got a camp, and it's awesome. I would almost focus more on breaking this up by mileage than I would by wanting super specific camps. So try to get equalish mileage every day the best you can, instead of being, set that you have to have a hospital bar, or, hospital bar and Laurel Grouse are, if I remember right, kind of far away. Like, when you're choosing those two camps, hospital bar, Laurel Grouse is like mile. Oh no, it's, yeah, what is hospital bar? I feel like Laurel Grouse and hospital bar are like 7 miles apart. I could be way wrong here. I have to visualize all this in my head right now. Or no, actually, they're pretty close. I'm thinking of something else. What am I thinking of? Anyway, I don't know what I'm thinking of. Yeah, Courtney, Vail Falls with a cup of coffee would be amazing. Yeah, amazing. Okay, hopefully I answered that question. Snow water supply is just one part of the equation. Soil moisture content is very important. As much of the West is simply really dry right now. So when the snow gets melted, yeah. So soil moisture content is important. It's just that we don't have like an internet gauge to look at soil moisture. So all we have to go off that I know of is snowpack. And it's been kind of a wettish spring, but there's no rain in the forecast. So, it depends on May. Like, if all of a sudden we get rain at the end of May and snow, like, we're going to be doing a lot better. If it just stays hot and melts the snow off, it's going to be not great. Either way, I will not accept. There's no situation here where I would call June 27th low water. It's lower than June 27th normally is. But if you look at a Middle Fork season, June 27th should be really good flows. Hospital bars and Laurel Grouse are 5 miles apart. Thanks for checking, Courtney. But yeah, so they're close-ish. Okay. Next question. Oh, this is a continuation of this one. Okay. All right. Unlike the Grand, where you can mostly float until you're tired, the U.S. Forest Service campsite designations in the Middle Fork force us into a rigid plan. For those of us who don't get to pull a permit every year, we're balancing a lot. Boater skill levels, gear prep, and the fear that one wrap boat on day one ruins the whole itinerary. So I'm going to make the case that reserved camps are better for everybody. Like, you don't want non-reserved camps in the Middle Fork. It would be a disaster. It's like the Rogue, but it would be worse because people would, it would be almost worse in the Middle Fork. My take is you want to have the skills to do the Middle Fork so you don't have problems, or you minimize your problems. But it forces a rigid plan. I'm going to claim that's a good thing. I'm going to claim it for 90% of the people out there. They agree that's a good thing. If you think campsite reservations on the Middle Fork is a bad thing, let me know in the comments. I'm super curious if anybody thinks that. And actually, just like, if you can, I wonder if I can do a votey thing. There was a way to do a votey thing. Can I create a votey thing? And we just put in the comments. Do you think reserved camps are good or just open, just free for all? Like, on the Grand Canyon, there's plenty of camps, right? The Grand Canyon is quite a bit different because there are a lot of camps. There's plenty of backup camps. And you really don't know what you're doing 12 days from now. The Middle Fork, you can kind of, you, you, you can stay in an itinerary for 5 nights or 6 nights. You're doing it's pretty easy. I wouldn't worry about a boat wrapping on day one ruining an itinerary. It's pretty rare to have a boat wrap on day one. Yeah, and especially the level you're going at, I'm not worried about that. We often spend months gathering intel from guidebooks and social media, only to get skunked by the Forest Service when you only get one of our 6 campsite choices. It leads to a tough strategy call. Do you swing for the fences on primo hot spring camps and risk getting terrible sights the rest of the trip? Or do you pick safe mid-tier camps and just visit the highlights during the day? I kind of touched on this earlier. I don't think hot spring camps are better, honestly. Like, the campsites themselves aren't that great. They just happen to be close to a hot spring, which it's not like you can sit in a hot spring for 2 hours. Like, you know, you can be in there for 20 minutes and be done. You might as well do it midday. So, I mean, on the middle fork, I just wouldn't stress about this that much because the camps, they're all pretty much good camps. Like, there's some camps are better than others. Like, Lower Grouse is better than Upper Grouse for sure, right? But if Lower Grouse didn't exist, you would love Upper Grouse, right? If Upper Grouse was on the Rogue, you would take it. It would be the most popular camp on the Rogue potentially, right? So, like, it's just, it's comparison. I feel like somebody said once I was getting a trip and they said comparison is the thief of joy. Like, just get some camps and just be happy. I think stressing out over, you know, I think spending months looking at guidebooks and social media and trying to figure it all out, I think the anxiety from that isn't worth it. Like, you're going to get what you're going to get and like, be happy. And I'm telling you this as like, this is, I do this for a living. Like, I pick camps for our trips for a living. Like, I do it all summer long. I sit down, fill out the stupid form, and like, I don't pick the best camps. Like, I occasionally swing for the fences on my favorite camp, which I'm not going to mention, but I also know everybody else's. And so it's like kind of gambling. If I take like the third or fourth best camp, I know I'm going to get the third or fourth best camp. And then I'm stoked, right? I'm like, oh, cool. It's a great camp. And if I get the worst camp, I'm bummed. But what really sucks is what happens when small groups take large camps, and that forces me into this elk bar situation when I have to do 20 miles of low water, whatever it is, 22, I can't remember. It's like, maybe it's 18. I have to do a lot of miles of low water so people can make flights. That's a bummer to me. Like, that's when it stresses me out. But other than that, like, all the camps are great. Mileage will mess you up because if you don't pay close attention, you're going to have like a 27, 30 mile day, and that will ruin a trip. Like, when you're, you know, especially in the June, it can get windy. If you have a, you know, a 27, let's say you have the best camp ever night four, you got your favorite camp of all time night four, right? But it's a 27 mile day to get there, and it's windy. And so you get there at like 5 o'clock exhausted. You don't get to enjoy the camp. And so I would say that the mileages, getting the mileages somewhat, and it's hard to do the way they do camp picks now because you have to do first, second, third, fourth picks, but just try to make the mileage work is the best you can, more than the quality of the camp. Because again, you might have to be super stoked for a camp, but the mileage gets you. Okay, cool. Here we go. Some comments. I love assigned camps. Kind of sucks going farther and farther when each camp is taken in your group of start. Yeah, on the Rogue, it's the worst, especially when you're guiding a trip with 20 people on it and there's 3 people camped in a 30-person site. It is the worst. And I don't know. We're going to go until we find a camp. I don't know. We'll keep going. Maybe there's a camp around the corner. Like, it's horrible. The Grand Canyon, it's not as a big of a deal because there are a lot of camps in the Grand Canyon. There's enough. On the Middle Fork and the Rogue, there's just enough camps for everybody. Right? There's just enough. It has to be assigned. On the Rogue, there's plenty of camps too. The problem with the Rogue is everybody upsizes, commercial and private, not just private. This is commercials too. Everybody takes a camp bigger than their group. Like, some people upsize a lot, like a 3-person. I've seen 1 person at a 30-person camp, right? And he was naked, so we're definitely not going to go share with him, right? But I've also seen 4 people at a 30-person camp. But usually what happens on the Rogue Those are like anomalies that really mess everything up, is that a group of six takes a 15-person camp and a group of 15 takes a 30-person camp, right? Everybody's upsizing a bit. And if everybody upsizes, that's when it just all falls apart. And because everybody upsizes, commercial companies are forced to spend a boat ahead, and that creates all the animosity and all, you know, whatever. It's a whole disaster, right? And the rogues, culturally, there is a lot of animosity and anger between user groups. That anger and animosity does not exist on the Middle Fork. It doesn't, not in the same way. There's always like differences between groups. Like, this is just life. But like, there is palpable animosity between user groups and the rogue. And I'm not just saying private versus commercial, between user groups. Let's just leave it at that. On the Middle Fork, there's much more like a sense of getting along and respect, because the assigned camps. Yeah, Courtney, assigned camps are the best. Yeah, try being a guy on the rogue for a season. You will appreciate assigned camps more than anybody. Do you have a couple camps that avoid the whole mess, like camps to help solidify mileage? I mean, I think night one, my general take, if I'm doing five nights, is night one, camp around mile 13. Night two, camp around mile 30-ish. Night three, camp around mile 50. Night four, camp around mile 70. Night five, camp around mile 85. Right? That's how I would do it. I'm just thinking of where the camps are bunched that way. They're already kind of bunched that way. But if you're like they're in bunches. But if you have the first night three camp and the last night four camp, that can lead to a 27, 28 mile day, right? And that's when problems happen, when you have to go 28 miles. And then if you have a wrap on day three, and if you have a wrap in the morning and if you're 28 miles that day, that's what leads to problems, right? So like, it's not the camps. It's just think about your like selections. Just try not to be like, if you're going to pick the beginning of the night three camps, don't pick the end of night four camps. Like, be like, even though the last camp is maybe the best camp on the river, again, you could get there and be just exhausted, right? And just not even get to enjoy it. Okay, cool. Good question. All right. Okay, there's more. For June 27th launch, we're expecting low water. I think I already read that. Again, I don't expect low water. Expect great water. It's June 27th. Our strategy. Oh, yeah, I already read this. Oh, yeah, no, I didn't. Our strategy is to plan very short miles early on. If we run clean, we enjoy a long afternoon at camp. Yeah, that's probably going to happen. You're probably going to have those first 2 days, you're probably going to need to camp super early. If we wrap a boat, we aren't stressed about making a massive trek to a designated spot. I don't think you're going to wrap a boat. I think the fear is at low water. And when I say low water, I mean end of July, August. That this year, that's going to be low water. It's just getting stuck over and over and over and over. Wrapping doesn't happen that often on the Middle Fork. It's inexperienced groups who have small, they think, oh, it's low water, bring a smaller boat. And they bring the same amount of stuff, right? They don't go lighter. So the boat, their normal boat's this big. They decide to bring a boat this big, but they don't bring less stuff, and the boat sits more in the water. So instead of being on the top of the water, they're sitting like this, and you see them just getting, they have a heavy boat for the size, and their skills aren't there. And so they're just getting stuck, you know, like 30 times a day, right? At whatever the flow is going to, unless there's an act of God, whatever the flows you're going to have June 27th are not those flows. You should be able to float over it's the shallows too. It's not the rapids. It's these like really wide shallow sections in between the rapids that people get stuck forever, right? It's the rapids too, but it's the shallows. So, you know, I'm not worried about the flows, and you know, unless like right, unless all the snow melts next week and it's low water beginning of June, every indication right now is that you'll have gray water June 27th. Okay. Zach, how should private boaters find the balance between achieving the perfect trip on paper and the reality of falling apart the moment you hit the water? I think I've covered that pretty well. Just don't worry about it. Like, just do your best. It's all going to work out fine, or it won't work out fine. There'll be a problem, and that's just life. But like, I would just, I would just, you know, do your best to pick camps mileage wise. Don't get stressed in the details. And that's my best advice for that. So hopefully that helps. Hopefully that helps a little bit. Okay, here we go. Next question. Static line to a raft. What's the best way to get a static line from the shore to a raft stuck boat and vice versa? Is it true you should ideally keep it dry as well? Okay, so I saw this question ahead of time because it was submitted through the Whitewater Guidebook. I did see this question ahead of time. I'm going to answer the second question first. Should you ideally keep your rope dry? Yeah, you should ideally keep it dry. Do you have to? No. Like, ropes still work when they're wet. Maybe not as well. Maybe they're not strong. But, like, it's the rope you have. You'll be fine, right? But, like, ideally, yeah, keep it dry. If it's your static line, right? Throwback ropes are meant to get wet. They float. Static lines, you know, they get wet sometimes. They still work. But ideally, yeah, keep it dry. That's why, like, I would keep my static line in a dry bag. I noticed, like, if you look at the NRS pin kit, it comes in like a mesh bag. You don't want your rope in a mesh bag where it's getting wet all the time, right? Or sandy. You want to protect your static line the best you can. Okay. One more question before I go on with this. Any thoughts on South Salmon Peak? I have no idea. Yeah. It's going to be earlier than usual. Yeah, because that's just the case. I don't know. I don't really know the South Fork Salmon flows that well, but based on what I know, I'd probably mid to late June, probably. I don't know. Okay. So anyway, what am I doing here? I'm going to remove this. I'm going to remove this. I'm going to share another screen from our online rescue course, which I talked about last week. And I'll talk about in the commercial segment here in a second. This is one of the lessons here. And these are videos that we went out and like took time to professionally produce. And this is an example of what it kind of looks like.
The purpose of this video is to demonstrate big picture scene safety. The rescue techniques used in this.
Okay, there we go. So this is, let me see, can I make this big and it'll work? Yeah, so this is a video that just walks through what it looks like. So step one is you take your throw bag and you throw it out to the boat and hopefully you make it. Hopefully you don't take like 10 tries. You can get it on try one. And this is, again, we set this up as a simulation. This isn't a real wrap, obviously. So if you're like, that guy's not really wrapped, it's more for the simulation. You make your throw. That's what it looks like. You get the rope and you try to keep the rope above the water. If the throw bag falls in the water is going to start moving it and somebody might let go. It's pretty common, right? And so you can see the guy on the boat working hard to keep the rope lined up. And then here he's attaching. Oh yeah, there we go. There's a static line ready to go. Oh, we're not sending a static line over. We're sending webbing over. Sorry, I haven't watched this in a while. And so for this person to do an anchor, they need webbing. And so he's attaching a throw bag to the other throw bag and sending webbing over so the person on the raft can do their anchor. And now this is also how you would send a static line over. We may get to this in this video. This video is more about big picture scene safety, not specifically about getting a static line to a raft. But if that second rope was a static line, you would pull it over and ideally with the webbing. Because you need the webbing to do a three-point anchor. You can't really do you can do a two-point anchor with a flip line or with a small piece of webbing, but it's really, you really want, does he let this rope go? Or does he send a static line over? I can't remember. Anyway, the webbing went over and let's see what happens here. You can see now that he has the webbing, he tied the rope off to the boat. So it like, it's not gonna go away. And then he's doing a three-point anchor. Or this is a two-point. Sorry, this is a two-point anchor. But even to do 2 points, you need 20 feet of webbing. Or like, depending on the D-rings. But the gold standard is becoming the three-point anchor. And now it looks like, I'm guessing, he's going to try pulling on the boat with the throw bag. Which is, and he's trying angles out. You can see like he moves around. He's trying different angles. They're trying another D-ring Like before you just jump into mechanical advantage, right? Like try pulling from different places on the boat, try pulling from different angles. So now he's going to retie the anchor back there. I forgot how well produced we did this, like, I don't know, 8 or so years ago. I forgot how well we did on this. I'm fast forwarding. I think now, I wonder if we're sending over static line. There we go. So this is standing over static line. You attach the static line to that bag, and now you're just going to pull it over slowly. So there's other things you can do for sure, but this is sort of the standard thing, right? Like use a throw bag to send a static line over. And the advantage of the static line is it's stronger. So if you're doing mechanical advantage, you probably want a static line. There are spectral ropes. You can, you know, use a spectral throwback rope too. But the static line is going to be easier to grip because it's thicker rope. It's stronger and it has less stretch. And you can notice how we're working to keep the rope out of the water. Now, if it goes in the water, the world's not going to end. We're going to be fine. But if it gets in the water, it does change how the rope works a little bit. And if it does drop in the water, the current is going to whisk it away. It's harder to hold on to. So see how he continues to hold the rope up. Another thing you can do is put a prusik at the end of a paddle, the handle of the paddle with a carabiner, and hold it up that way too. That's another way to hold it up. Now he's stuffing his throw bag just so it doesn't have a rope in here. And now we're going to set up the mechanical advantage system and go on from there. Don't worry, this is a long video we put together a few years ago. So hopefully that explains that one, right? What's the best way to get static line from the shore to a wrap stuck boat and vice versa? The answer again is get a throw bag over there, right? And on the end of the throw bag, tie some webbing for a 3-point anchor or a 2-point anchor at a minimum, attach the static line and pull it over. Okay, cool. And stop this. All right, are we at the commercial break yet? Yeah, good timing. So while we're at commercial break, I just want to share, this is our online rescue class, and it's something that I've been slowly developing for like 5 years, and it's cost $25. The cost has been $25, and it's just like a foundation, has like mainly the knots, some rescue stuff, some throwback stuff, or flipping, quite a bit of orboat flipping, anchors, knots, mechanical advantage. And it's something I'm now putting a lot of time into, like really filling it out to be a pretty complete course. And so I finally have like created the lesson plans, got the video together. When I do Gear Garage, there's not usually a lesson plan. I just start talking and hopefully I say correct things. When I do this, there's usually a lesson plan behind it. There's always a lesson plan behind it. And I'm very careful to like get the details correct. And so these videos are generally better produced videos. Like I did this one yesterday on self-team victim. And, you know, I've got my cameras working better. And I really make sure I clean it up the best I can. So these are a number of videos that are up there. I would say it's like 30% complete. I'm going to add a lot more to it over the summer. I have a lot of things ready to go. Right now, if you go to Whitewater Education, it's $25. I'm going to raise the price in like a few days to $45. If you buy now, you, as I add things, you get them forever. You'll always have this to refer to. So I just want to give everybody a heads up that as my part of my commercial break, that's available to purchase. And the price is going to end up being $95 when I get it done, hopefully this year. Okay, end of the commercial break. The next question. Love the show. Thanks for doing the work to make it happen. Yeah. In your last show, you mentioned how you can crack an oar shaft when it's rigged on a truck in transit. It got me wondering about the best practices for rigging a trailer with a raft for a long drive. How concerned do you get with cam straps rubbing on rubber? I have zero concern. Do you keep the pack cooler on the raft or in the climate control car? I don't know how I would keep a cooler inside of a car. They're too big. It would help. I mean, if you have ice packed food in a cooler, depending on how far, like I never, you know, we have warehouses right next to the rivers we do. So we just do short drives. If you're driving a long way, anything you do to protect ice is good. If you can put it inside your cab, it's going to help. when you go over a mountain pass, you're letting air, letting out some air. Yes, I am definitely letting out air over a mountain pass. Let me see if I can move this thing. How do I move this thing? This thing is really cool. This comment thing is cool, but I can't read stuff always. Okay, after the pass, do you add air back in the tubes? No, because it's kind of a pain. I just tighten the straps. So like once you let air out, and you know, when you're going up, you gotta tighten them right there. And if they get looser, you just gotta pull over every so often and check them. If you're going up and down elevation a lot, like when I say up and down a lot, I mean like 1500, a couple thousand feet, you need to make some adjustment up and down, whether it's to the flotation and the straps. And you know, if they get overinflated, the straps are pulling really tight. That's how D-rings can blow, and baffles and everything. I'm curious how see other people do it. I'm sure I can learn something new. So yeah, good questions. Okay, again, I don't worry about cam straps from rubbing on rubber. They could be a problem. I don't think it is. I do everything I can to keep my coolers cold, whatever that takes. If you can put it inside a car, do it. In the mountain pass, I let it air. When I go over the pass, I check it. Yep, that's definitely worth paying attention to. If anybody else has anything to add, please do. This show is almost done, so you have like not very long to cost this. Okay, Brendan, are you going to be at ClaxFest? If so, any recs on renting or demoing a boat? I am. You missed the beginning of the show, Brendan Droll, right? I actually promoted the ClaxFest right there. Boom. I'll be there. Recs on renting or demoing a boat? Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, all the good manufacturers will be there with boats. And you can contact them ahead of time and just say, hey, you, can I demo a boat? Or you can just show up and do it. Like, and again, I haven't been in a couple of years. I'm telling you how it used to be. And maybe things change. I don't know how things are now. But it should be the case that you can just show up and talk to them and be like, I want to try that boat out. And they might be like, hey, somebody else has it at 11:30. Do you mind waiting? Or they might be like, yeah, cool, I'll take you up there. So I know the raft manufacturers do like hearing ahead of time. If some of them do, if you want to demo a boat, you're sure. Especially if you know what you want. If there's a specific boat you want, that might change what they bring. So if you email them and say, hey, I've always wanted to try the Merlin series raft, Sotar, could you bring one to demo? That might motivate them to bring that boat instead of them just guessing what to bring. Or I've always wanted to try your 12-foot cat. You know, it might change what they bring. And also you might just, you know, them hearing from you ahead of time will probably make them more responsive to you in person. But you can, again, like just, you know, grab a boat, throw on a trailer sometimes and go. And it's super easy to demo a boat. I wouldn't rent a boat for ClaxFest because you shouldn't need to. There should be plenty of demos. Yep. Good question. Okay. Well, I think we did it. I think we got through a lot. That was a lot of Middle Fork stuff. Hopefully that was helpful. Hopefully that was helpful information. And thank you all for watching. Thank you all for supporting the show, for asking questions, for saying nice things once in a while. While I have you, please hit the subscribe button. Oh my gosh, I'm trying so hard to get to 100,000 and I have so far to go. I only have like 15,000 and I wanted to get to 100. So like, I need as many as I can. So hit that subscribe button. It costs you nothing. It literally takes you just a couple, like it's just a click, right? If you don't like me, then don't subscribe, whatever. But why are you even listening to this if you don't like me? That's just ridiculous. So if you're listening to this and you haven't subscribed, please take a second and do it. It boosts my ego. It makes me feel so cool to say I have a lot of subscribers. So please do that. It literally is just an ego thing. I don't think there's any benefit that makes me feel special. And actually, I think gear companies are more likely to send me stuff to test. And the more stuff I get to test, the more stuff you all get to see. So, you know, occasionally gear companies will send me, like, I got that NRS Vector PFD the other day to test, probably because NRS knows I have a lot of subscribers. I don't know for sure that's why, but, you know, I can do more reviews. Like I buy stuff for sure, right? I buy a lot of this stuff to review, the stuff I want to review, but gear companies will sometimes send me something, say, hey, tell me what you think. And, it gives me a chance to have more things. So anyway, there's a long way of saying, please subscribe. Thanks for watching. And I'll see you all next week.